Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds, where we get the stories of the record on the record. And this week we are brought to you by the new Groovewasher G3 Fluid. Yes, you heard right, Groovewasher has an even fancier record cleaning fluid for you vinyl nerds, and they call it the G3 and GSR, Groovewasher Super Rinse Fluid. Of course, Groovewasher still has the traditional G2 fluid as well, and all these come in small quantities for record hobbyists, as well as large 32 and even 64 ounce versions for hardcore record collectors and record stores. Just go to groovewasher.com to learn more. Use discount code VINYLGUIDE10 to save when you check them out. That's the Groovewasher G2, G3, and GSR cleaning fluids available at groovewasher.com. Discount code VINYLGUIDE10. And we're also brought to you today by AudiophileUSA.com. Used records only in excellent and near mint shape. Over 42,000 titles to choose from at AudiophileUSA.com. And they are always restocking and finding more. Dig around the website, search by genre, record label, and artist. Dig deep and find the deals, as well as sign up to be alerted when a new batch becomes available. That's AudiophileUSA.com, the best used records, the cleanest condition, all shipped directly to your front door. That's AudiophileUSA.com. This week on The Vinyl Guide, thank you all are going to enjoy this one because we have the always entertaining author, music fan, and record rapscallion, Mr. Eric Spitznagel, who, besides being a record collector and suffering the same sickness as most of us, has just authored a book, Rockstars on the Record, where Eric interviews dozens of well-known musicians about their earliest vinyl record memories and the records that influenced their lives. He talks to many greats in the book, including Ian MacKaye, Wayne Kramer, Perry Farrell, and a heap more. And I really encourage you to check it out. It is absolutely hilarious. Rockstars on the Record, the album that changed their lives, available wherever you buy your books. Now, Eric was one of the earliest guests on The Vinyl Guide way back in 2016, touting his then-current book, Old Records Never Die, which documented his search for the records he once gave up years ago. Now, as many of us foolishly did, Eric traded in his vinyl collection only to seek it out again many decades later. But it wasn't just the titles that he was looking for. Eric was actually looking for the exact same physical records that he once gave up. And Old Records Never Die talks about that journey. It's another great book for record collectors, and you can hear Eric talking more about it way back on episode 32 of The Vinyl Guide. So not much more to say, really. Let's jump into our conversation with the always hilarious Mr. Eric Spitznagel.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you and I can see you.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing. How are you, Nate?
I'm doing good. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It feels like it's been at least a few years. The passage of time goes too quickly these days.
Well, yeah, 2016. Boy, we were so innocent then.
That's right. Oh, my God. Remember things like restaurants and touching people? That was a good time.
Yeah, hugging hobos. Yeah, that's all out the window for the moment. Oh,
I feel like it's been a century since I've hugged a hobo. It's been way too long.
Mm, I missed the must. actually, over here in Australia, we're kind of back to normal now. I don't know if you've
because you guys, you're not idiots. That's the difference. We're kind of a nation of morons who think that no one can interfere with my freedom. That's why everything is going.
Look, we've got our fair share of morons as well. What we did different is that we had, we've got essentially the same thing as the Republicans and the Democrats. We've got two parties that pretty much control everything, but at least they came together on this and they listened to scientists and they both said, everyone, fucking stay home, wear masks, and everyone said okay. There was no room for dissension, and there were a few dickheads that were like freedom, but they were quickly sorted. So anyway, I'm sorry that you guys are you know, struggling that way.
Yeah, so am I.
Well,
it's all down to very simple things, I think. Like a face mask. Come on. How difficult is that to live with? I mean, it just boggles my mind how it's gone on this long.
It comes down to just consideration for other people. So
yes, 100%, right?
Yeah. And well, look, the one thing it's probably brought in, the one small positive of the whole thing is we were able to sit inside and listen to records more.
That's right. And I know so many people who have had that same experience where because we're slowing down a lot, the patience required for a record to put it on and just sit there and not skip through and not look for another artist. It's amazing what I've seen from people and how they've kind of changed some of their listening habits and and how because we're being forced to take a breath and not scurry about our lives to really reappreciate some of this music. I mean, some of the music I've re-explored during this time or you know, kind of delved into, even in writing this book, it's like, you know what, I'm just going to listen to everything that they like before we talk, so I can really feel like I'm immersed in their world, that I'm in their teenage bedroom, sitting on the floor.
Okay, so that's interesting. And so writing this book, Rockstars on the Record, you spoke to about 36, or at least you documented about 36 artists and the music and the albums that changed their lives. You actually went back and listened to the records that they cited to try to, I guess, live in their shoes for that moment?
Yeah, I didn't want to. I kind of went back and forth with it, whether I should just go in blind and ask them about records and be surprised and have them lead me through it. Mm-hmm. But I really felt it would bring something more to these conversations if I asked them in advance, what kind of records do you want to talk about? Because I don't just want to do my research. I want to, you know, get lost in that world and really go down those rabbit holes so that I can kind of get a sense of where their brain was at and meet them on an equal footing. Rather than like, I don't know who Crass is. What the hell are you talking about?
So were there any particular records that you connected with more than others in this process?
That's interesting. Yes. I mean, the people who I felt the closest kinship with, people like Craig Finn of the Hold Steady. I mean, bringing up the Replacements, which are so near and dear to my heart that nothing's going to make me love them anymore at this point. So that was kind of a no surpriser. But when like Donny Osmond wanting to talk at length about Stevie Wonder, and I haven't really listened to Stevie Wonder in years. I mean, not where I sit down like I'm going to play this record and intently focus on it. And really let it wash over me. And so that was kind of a pleasant, like when you rediscover records and artists that you kind of took for granted, I think, because I find my, like, I'm so intensely focused on my kind of Midwestern punk that becomes your whole world. And I mean, that was a challenge too, is to try to get as many different artists involved who have tastes that are vastly different than my own, whose genres are different. So yes, and things like Crass, who was it? I forget her name, but I was not even aware of Crass, quite frankly. This punk band from the early '80s. I'd heard the name, but never really tracked down any of the music. So to sit and listen to that and discover it and feel like I was, you know, as Lauren put it, to feel like I could smell the cigarettes from a Florida mall, and that you've got this record in your, or this cassette in her case, and sitting in the car and playing it after you've panhandled the money to buy this thing, and just the cigarettes and the heat of Florida, and trying to get myself in that mindset and that feeling of what that was like, that desperation, that, you know, music is the only thing keeping you alive at that point.
So you have in this book, like I said, about 35, 36 interviews. Did you do more interviews? Are there interviews that you did that didn't make the book?
There were a few that kind of were a little rambly, or I was trying to, or they broached some of the same topics, and there were quite a few that almost happened that didn't, you know, come down to the wire in time. Like just as we'd finished the draft, George Clinton, you know, signed on to do it. I was like, oh George Clinton. Oh, and we were dangerously close with Morrissey, and I could listen to Morrissey, you know, ramble likely about the New York Dolls, but I don't care. I'll listen to him talk about the New York Dolls all day and all night. It would be a pleasure.
All right. Well, look, if you're curious on George Clinton's records, we've had him on episode 61. So he talks about his earlier. You and I have a lot of crossover in this regard, because that's a lot of what I talk to different artists
that's
about.
Interesting.
What was your first record? What was your formative record? What is the record that changed your brain?
Right.
And yeah, I think we've had a bit of crossover. Angelo Moore, Wayne Kramer. And it was very interesting hearing the same story from two different angles. Oh, he's great. He's great.
Right.
In our interview, at one point he was driving, and at one point he said, "Oh my God, there's a cop here," and he hung right up.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny that it's still in his head. Oh, that's so good.
I should make that my ringtone. Anyway, so
you know what I want? Sorry to interrupt. One thing I want for my ringtone. I was talking to Donny Osmond about Stevie Wonder, mm-hmm. and he had to play Stevie Wonder. He's like, "I want to hear the music. I want to hear," and then he put on this record, and like the whole time I was like, "Shh, oh yeah, oh, ooh," and I kind of felt like I was hearing Donny Osmond in a moment of sexual bliss, because it was that kind of ooh. And that's what, be quiet for, there it is. There it is. And that's what I want for my ringtone, is Donny Osmond reaching some kind of euphoric peak every time someone's calling, just Donny Osmond going, oh, yeah. That's perfect.
Do you have any records that make you make audible sounds like that?
That's a good question. To make audible, I think it's been years since it's had that effect. I don't think in recent history that something makes me groan in that. Oh yeah, there it is. there's the stuff. I feel maybe that's a lacking too. I want to get back to a place where it can hit me on that level rather than. I mean, it's hard when you listen on the record so much to break away from listening to them intellectually and take them in. Emotionally. I mean, that was something too, when I tried to put it out there for artists when they were agreeing to do this, is that I don't want to talk about the music that hit you in your head, that made you go like, oh, I had that chord change and the way that they approach this. I see how I want to approach music. What's the thing that hit you in your gut? What's the thing that made you feel less alone? And that, you know, what's the record that made you tell your parents to fuck off? What's the one that made you, you know, feel like I don't have any sense of my identity, but I feel it's like a warm blanket. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, where it's that gut feeling and the way they approach that with such fervor and not, you know, not getting into the weeds about the technical side or this, how it's influenced them as an artist, but how it impacted them as a human being. I think that was the key for me.
Now, these days, can you sit and enjoy music and allow yourself to be fully consumed in it?
It's more difficult. I mean, that's why I've become more obsessed with vinyl over the last decade, because I love Spotify. I love finding new music that way. I love, getting lost, going down the rabbit hole. But to get a record and sit with it and the whole thing. I mean, I remember I've had a few of these conversations, but remembering a time when you were younger and when you bought a record and you're like, I'm taking a risk. Because I may know one song on there. I may know zero songs. Mm-hmm. And if you're of limited income and you bring it home, you're like, oh, please don't suck. Please don't suck. And even if it sucks, you're going to listen to it from beginning to end because it's your purchase. You made that commitment. And there were a few times when I remember listening to records and the first time I was like, I don't like that, but I'm going back again and I'm going to find my way into it. I mean, The National, who is a beloved band to me right now, in the beginning, I was having a hard time. But once it breaks through, when you give it that patience and really, really listen, I think it brings you to another place.
I had a record when I was young, Black Sabbath, Born Again.
Yes.
It was one of the first records I really bought with my own money that my brothers and sisters didn't influence me on. And I forced myself to listen to it and kind of forced myself to like it. And even to this day,
wow,
I'm wondering, do I like it because it's good, or do I like it because I forced myself? I told myself it was good.
That's a good question. I mean, there's these transitions we go through. For the book, I was talking with Mitski. I don't know if you're familiar with Mitski.
Mm.
She is well worth checking out, but she's, I think, barely like 24, 25 at this point. And I could be incredibly wrong, but an amazing artist. And she was telling me about first discovering like Bjork, and she would go to those listening stations at the mall and put on one of Bjork's records.
Oh,
and
Vespertine, she was like,
a Vespertine, yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And just being terrified, just absolutely going like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I heard that. It's going to give me nightmares. And then gradually coming back to it and finding her way into it, because there was something about it that was so fascinating at the same time that it was terrifying. I mean, the first time I heard the Pixies, I was like, I'm never leaving my house again. I'm slicing up eyeballs? Why would you slice up eyeballs? Francis Black is just a scary dude. But once you get in there, oh, so much sweetness.
What's the most touching story that you found doing this project?
Touching story. That is a very good question. I think it's probably James Petrolli. He's a singer for White Denim. And he told me about being young and poor and not in the best situation in his life. And he would go to the mall and steal records from this place called CD Warehouse. Mm-hmm. And the staff there was very aware. There was this one guy in particular who was very aware that he was stealing records and would sometimes stop him and go like, you don't want those. Like there was a period when he was like, he'd heard about the Black Crowes. So he bought some Black Crowes records, and the guy stopped him and like, no, give me that. You're going to listen to the Allman Brothers. And there was something like, he developed this relationship with this guy who was just like, not only not busting him, but becoming kind of a musical mentor and giving him advice on which records to steal. So it's that weird mix of like, we all have in some cases a musical mentor, someone, whether or not mm-hmm. they realized they were a mentor who we were kind of following in their footsteps. But this guy who very easily could have, you know, called the cops on him and sent him to jail, instead kind of helping him out. And this like 16-year-old kid who clearly doesn't have a pot to piss in and now is discovering these bands because of this, you know, staff guy who took pity on him. So it was for something about those little moments are so sweet. And also anytime someone told me a story about finding records through a big brother or the big brother of a friend, it's like back in our youth, how, you know, there used to be Playboys in the woods and everyone had to find their pornography that way. Records had to be passed around. You had to find, there was like these, it was like discovering the lost ark when you go into a brother's closet and there's like, oh, what is this? It's weird looking cover, but I got to take it home to see what secrets are in there. and there was one story that I swear should be like a docuseries or a movie. What is his actual name? Mike Bishop, who's the lead singer right now of GWAR. Mm-hmm. He's Blother the Berserker, Berserker Blother.
Something like that, yeah.
Just, you know, blood spewing at the audience. And he told me about growing up in this very conservative Baptist, Southern Baptist, you know, household. And his grandparents were so devoutly, devoutly religious. And he'd go through their records and, you know, not much of anything that's really going to get your blood coursing. But with one grandmother, he was like the most religious of the two. Mm-hmm. He was looking through the records and pulled out this copy of Kiss, Rock and Roll Over. And he was like, what is a Kiss record? And first of all, he had no idea what it is. Just these guys in makeup looking like, you know, Satan's minions. And he showed it to his friends and they're like, oh my God, the devil put that there. They're all convinced that clearly this somehow, the only way this record could have somehow gotten into your grandmother's collection was it's the work of the devil. So he held on to it and listened to it and had this magic to it. And his grandmother has long since passed on, and he doesn't know, like, how did it get in there? Did it, I mean, there's no explanation because no one in her periphery would begin to listen to something like that. So this mystery kind of stays with him. And part of the reason he went down that road of music was this accidental, you know, needle in a haystack, no idea how it could have happened discovery. And just the idea of this little kid listening to, like, Dr. Love, what are they talking about? It's horrible. For some reason, I love that.
It must have been the devil. No other explanation. It has to be
the devil. The devil brings us records where we need them most. I
think we all. Yeah, at a time and a juncture of our lives, the devil's there for us.
Yes.
So did you have a musical mentor at all? Someone who recommended things, passed down records, influenced a young Spitznagel?
They were a couple of guys in high school who I was not cool enough to be around them, but I paid attention to the bands, the logos that they would draw on their notebooks. Mm-hmm. And there were a few record stores I would go to. In my teen years, we were in the south suburbs of Chicago, and I would take the train down to the city to this to the record stores there. And mm-hmm. and there was this one record store, Reckless, that I went to a lot. And there's something about, like, record store employees that I still... Like, it gives me a little, I'm never more insecure than around a record store employee because they're just so
the masters.
You just want it. Like, you, they are with the tattoos. And I still remember the first time I went to a record store in the city, and this guy, oh my God, he just looked like a freaking nose ring and, like, you know, dreads, and everything was, you know, the band t-shirt, which I was probably, I don't know, Bad Brains or something. I was just like, what the heck? And I had come in there going, like, do you have the new Billy Joel? And just like, no, you don't come in here to look for the new Billy Joel. But they would recommend things, or they kind of guided me gently in certain directions. And when you discover something that you don't think any of your peers has heard before, mm-hmm. I mean, that's where I first got into, like, the Replacements, and in the suburbs, it was all, you know, Bon Jovi and, you know, Phil Collins, and to have this record and this band that it felt like a secret. Mm-hmm. And that's something a lot of people in the book have talked about. Like, it's when you have that secret, something that nobody else gets like you do. I mean, and I didn't understand half of what was in the Replacements' Let It Be. I mean, it's a lot of, you know, alcoholism and just really mm-hmm. deep despair. And I was mostly dealing with, you know, calculus and whether or not I could get a girl to go with me to the junior prom, mm-hmm. not, you know, questioning gender identity, which is really, you know, I mean, I was unsatisfied primarily about getting the car for the weekend. So it wasn't really the same thing mm-hmm. that punk ethos was maybe about.
Those record store employees, I've always held them in high regard. I can't remember a name of any of my teachers, but I can remember the record store guys. I remember there was a guy named Phil. There was a guy named Phil.
Wow.
And he worked at Tower Records. And I remember just, you know, and I know those guys are kind of living it rough a bit, but I always admired right. their ability to live with such abandon and enjoy music all day. That was always something yes. that I held in high regard.
Yes, yes. And that is your full-time job, is just filling your brain with all this music and being able to mm-hmm. lead people. I've never worked on a record store, and I kind of wish I had, but that you can't really rest easy on what you enjoy. And that was, I mean, part of the challenge of doing this book was trying not to get too comfortable in my sweet spot, mm-hmm. but to branch out to either genres or ages that I might not know much about. And it's hard to do. It's hard to do. And I don't know if I succeeded as much as I want to. I mean, I wanted to branch out even more in terms of gender, in terms of race, and in terms of musical genre. So, but it's, you know, it's, but at the same time, you also want to get a mix, so it's not going too radically in too mm-hmm. many different directions.
So going through this project, what did you learn? I mean, what music do you now put on that you didn't before you started writing the book.
That is interesting. In terms of music, I put on probably more jazz, weirdly enough, mm-hmm. mostly because of Wayne Kramer. Wayne Kramer, the way Wayne Kramer would talk about John Coltrane just made me like go, I literally need to back it up. And I mean, once you hear Wayne Kramer talking about listening to John Coltrane with, you know, dropping some acid and all the windows are open, and then a bunch of construction workers climb into his window to... and waking up going like, what the hell? Hey guys, you want to hang out and listen to some tunes? That casts a whole different light on John Coltrane for me. So that kind of opened it up, and more of a, I guess, soul and R&B. I'm heavier back into Stevie Wonder, which has brought me, you know, into like Earth, Wind and Fire. And some of those, like talking to the bassist from Earth, Wind and Fire about his family and about his brothers going to the studio every week to record some new song with mm-hmm. whether it was James Brown or anybody else, and then they bring home these 45s and just without even a label on them, and they just stack up in the house, and to listen to all these songs that are being recorded in the early 60s, and that was their life, and just churning them out. Oh, I'd play with Muddy Waters this week. And the way he painted that particular time period with just the way the streets in Chicago were, and how the kids would all gather outside school and bring music to play for each other. And that was kind of how you discovered anything. It was just, and even the thing that was really fascinating is him talking about the family record player. They only had that one family record player that everyone could listen to, but you had to put a nickel on top of the needle. That's the only way, because it would skip without it. Mm-hmm. And Verdon White, by the way, is from Earth, Wind and Fire, who's telling me about this. You got to need the nickel. There was a one nickel that was the perfect size, because change is like, it's a little bit different. If you lost that nickel, oh, you were in trouble. You got to keep that nickel on there and don't take it off, because you're going to scratch up the records, and that's everyone's records. And just in the moment of him remembering that nickel, he got so excited, and just so, because it's so visceral, and remembering those 45s. So that's made me want to go both into 60s soul and crass, weirdly, and areas of punk that are much deeper than I was accustomed to exploring before.
Mm. So in your last book, well, it wasn't your last book, but the last time we talked on the book, Old Records Never Die.
Yes.
You were just embarking on this journey to replace the records. And in fact, you were searching for some of the exact records, not just the same titles, but the exact physical records that you once let go. And in fact, you found one. I think it was Journey Escape. Was that the one that you
found? Oh, that's one of them. And then there was the Bon Jovi Slippery with When Wet, which had my girlfriend's first girlfriend's phone number written on it, which is it's a huge clue. And I was not a Bon Jovi fan during the time, but she was into it, and I was trying to mm-hmm. appear cool, and it's like, oh, I just have my copy of Bon Jovi Slippery with Wet, you know how it is. But found that, and I'm not as intense in that journey anymore. It's just, mm-hmm. it's gotten me back into loving vinyl music again. And that's really, in a non-snotty way, my preferred format, because I really do feel like it's a different relationship mm-hmm. with music, with vinyl, than it is everything else. That vinyl is where I really want to have a relationship with an artist or an album, where Spotify and iPod is a series of filthy one-night stands. That's just surfacey.
Vinyl is where you put the ring on the finger. And
right, that's, exactly.
That's where the commitment comes in. And it's not too cheap these days. So you're building back up your collection.
Yes.
Are you finding yourself spending a little bit too much money? Yeah, uncomfortable amounts in records?
Yes. It really... Yes, I've had some discussions with my wife about, do you have enough now? Like, this is not about have enough. This is never about, but yes, I would say that I have had a difficult conversation with my son about how he really college. You don't need college because dad needed these
records.
There's
going to be a revolution by then. You're not going to. Yeah. You know,
it's going to be, oh, there's going to be another plague. You're going to, education is all going to be online anyway.
Yeah.
Just hang out on YouTube. But yeah, it has become my pleasure. And everyone, my 9-year-old son, Charlie, it's become a cliche for him. Mm. He's like, oh, it's like my birthday was back in February. He's like, hey, what does daddy want for his birthday? Oh, never mind. Records. He wants records. So at least they all know that I want records. Like, oh, it's Christmas. What do you want? I want records. Or I would like just a white envelope full with cash, like you're paying off a mob boss. So I can just go to the record store and explore and discover things. So it's not as fun for people to give you that, but yeah, that's my jam, 100%.
Do you like it when people give you records? Because sometimes when people give me records, I'm like, oh, now I feel obligated to listen to it, and I kind of wasn't really in that mood, you know?
Oh, yeah, both the obligation and there's the hunt that I miss. Mm-hmm. If you just give me a record, it doesn't have the same feeling of discovering something you didn't know you were looking for, and there it is, and I didn't even know this is still in print, and there, oh my gosh. And even, you know, if like you find something like, this is only like $60, it's so cheap, and I just found it, like I've been foraging through the fields and like, look, these grapes aren't poisonous, these mushrooms, we could cook these mushrooms and live for another year. So yeah, I mean, it's nice if it's something, even if it's something I know I wanted, it just, if I don't go off, there's something about leaving a record store with a handful of records. You're like, I have done this. I have captured these records. I am the hunter. I like that. I like that experience.
I honestly think that exact feeling you're talking about comes from our lizard brain of gathering food or coming back from a hunt. It's like, here's what I got. Yeah. But that's our suburban equivalent, really. You know, that or Home Depot, like one of those two. Yeah. It's the same kind of part of the brain that does that.
About 6 months ago on a record store, at the record store, I found a copy of Tom Waits's Rain Dogs. And I still have not stopped talking to my wife about it. And she's like, I understand. You can't find these everywhere. This is not a reissue. This is an old Rain Dogs on vinyl. And some of that, like, well, sure. Like in some places, they're selling for like $300. And I got it for like $30. She's like, I still don't care. Well, you really should care. You should care just, so deeply about this.
Just tell me I'm smart. That's all I need.
Tell me I'm a good provider. Yeah. Well, can we eat rain dogs?
Yes.
I still feel good about myself.
When someone gives me a record and I didn't go through that process, it's like having a baby, but not the privilege of making it. Right? You want to go through that process to be there from the very beginning.
Oh God.
So what do you think of box sets? That. If you have like, cause you know, they're albums, single albums, you know, and that was always right. The social currency, but that was also the output of a lot of decisions and artists kind of going through the process. But now, for instance, right. I just got this Black Sabbath Volume 4 set, and it's like 5 records. It's right. Just, you know, every outtake and that, those sort of things. Are you into that at all?
The collector part of me is the part of me, the completist part who wants to have everything that an artist ever did. But there's also a part that knows like, this is just something I'm buying that I'm going to listen to once or twice and then not. Rarely do I go back to the bootlegs or the demos or the outtakes again and again and again. So yeah, I mean, I know that it just looks pretty on my shelf with all the other records, but there's a large part of my brain that knows like, you're just a sucker. They tricked you into buying that box set and you did it. And they know, you know, you're going to do it again. They're going to, they will totally put on another box set of something. You'd be like, I have to have that. But, I mean, I've got all the Dylan box sets that come out, the bootleg series. And I can't help myself with that. And some of those I do listen to and again, but mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm always torn on that. It's like knowing that you're making a bad decision and then just making it again. Like Wilco just recently did a box set of Summer Teeth, I think it was. And I was like, I know I could just buy outtakes on iTunes. I don't need to buy the record again with this second and third mm-hmm. record, but I bought it. I got it, and it's mm-hmm. in there on the W's. That and now, have you ever? Okay, here's something I need to bring up with you. Do you often, especially during this pandemic time, do you reorganize your records? Do you alphabetize them, or do you have different genres that that you put them in? Because I've recently started to reassess, and one of the interviews in my book is with Dave Perner, and he had like very interesting ways of recalculating where like it changes often for him. Mm-hmm. And one of his sections are artists who have died, which that's a big topic to handle. Cause like, what do you like? Does Queen go in there? Is it bands where they stopped playing once a major
right.
part of the band passed away, or does The Who go there? The Who didn't quit after Keith Moon died. Led Zeppelin goes there. I mean, and that forces you every time that you are go to look for an album to think about, are they all
what
alive?
If they're in a coma, you know?
Right. What is that? How do you do that? So I don't know. I'm curious. Like, do you have like, this is how I organize my records, or does it change on a whim for you?
Oh, it's a mess, really. Look, I've got an upstairs system, which is like my nice, really nice. Well, and when I say nice, I don't mean like super audiophile version. It's probably I've got my $2,000 stereo up there and my $1,000 downstairs, right? And so I have my records upstairs, but that tend to be my A records, and then downstairs are my yes. B records. But I'm not yes. always in that mood. So I'll actually have a crate that kind of goes back and forth. Like I'll find some records down here. It's like, oh, I haven't listened to this for a while. I'm looking forward to this, and I'll move it upstairs. Or I'm going to be working downstairs for an extended period of time. Let me go ahead and bring some stuff from upstairs downstairs. And my tastes shift all the time. There are times when, you know, there was one time where I was on a mad Beatles tear. And now I'm kind of tired of it. Like I listened to Sgt. Pepper the other day, and I thought to myself, I think that's the last time I'm going to listen to that. I think I've chewed the flavor out of it. I've got as much as I'm going to get out of it. Not that it's not a great album, not that it's incredible in its own right, but I think after so long, I'm getting to the point now to where the end is closer than the beginning, and I need to be very discerning about, okay, how am I going to spend my time? Am I going to listen to, you know, Beatles another five or six times, or am I going to try to learn something new?
Right.
So,
yes, I struggle with that constantly. Mm-hmm. In fact, part of my breakdown is I have the favorites, the current favorites mm-hmm. in a little section. And you really need to pay closer attention section. Like this is something that maybe isn't your favorite yet, but I've decided for the same reason that you just said, like there's less time than there was when you're 20 and you're like, I'm going to live forever and I can hear everything. And I'll just listen to this one, devoting yourself too much. And I've had conversations with friends about this recently. And for artists on the book, do you reach a certain age where you're like, I'm done ingesting new music? And I really have tried very hard not to be that person, as much as I enjoy certain bands and certain artists, to not stop listening and, mm-hmm. you know, searching for something new, or even something new that you didn't realize you missed the first time around. So I'm the consensus with many grown-ups in their 50s I've spoken to is like, I just don't have the time to figure out the music. I'm going to stick to my sweet spot. It was in the 90s or whatever. And I just think that's where death begins. Mm-hmm. that's when you've given up the chase. I know I'll hit a senile age where it's like, I really don't have and there's some new music I listen to, and it's like, I might as well have my pants up to my nipples, because it's like, that is loud. I don't understand. Daddy's blood pressure medicine is over there. Will you get it for him? Turn down the racket. But I'm not there yet. for the most part. So I want to keep, you know, challenging myself, and mm-hmm. and working on this book was a good way to do that, to see how people find things and see that, you know, our musical horizons are vast. Mm. And if you're patient with it, there's so much to be discovered.
Ah, that's beautiful. Yeah. So you're exiting this, this book cycle with a lot more wisdom, a larger record collection.
Yes.
A little bit more appreciation for music that you may have taken for granted or just even ignored first time around. Cause let's be honest, there's not enough time to be able to absorb everything. You have to put yeah. them in a bit of a sequence. And sometimes what yeah. I have, yeah. what I call entry points, I tried to get yeah. into jazz for years and years and I couldn't. Mm. And then finally I found this one entry point, this one Miles Davis album that got me in there. And then it started to make sense. Wow. Then I could branch out from there. So yes. I think the book, like you've just written, Rockstars on the Record, I think is a great place for people to be able to start. It's a Whitman sampler and whoever they gravitate towards artistically or how they have them speak of the record, I think is a great starting point.
I love music origin stories. Like if you can listen to someone talk about music, and even if you don't know exactly the record they're talking about, that mm-hmm. we all come from the same place, the excitement of discovering something, how it feels like it's saving your life, and sometimes literally for people mm-hmm. it is. But there's something about, I could listen to anybody talk about any record that they discovered, and that doesn't matter if I have no idea who it is, but their journey to getting there, whether it be from brothers or record store employees or family members or random people that they met, our friend Angela Moore from Fishbone, and how he discovered Bad Brains, just a dude on the bus handing him a cassette. Mm-hmm. What a beautiful way to, I wish there were more random dudes just saying like, you need to hear this. If a random dude on the bus handed me a cassette, I would take it like he's an angel from heaven come down to impart upon me what my next step should be. I absolutely love that. So, and some of these tales, I really like. I've known some people who are like, I'm afraid of reading the book because I don't know who all the artists are, and like that should not matter, because the best tales are not. It's not there to make you feel dumb or I don't understand who this person is or who their influences are, but it's how we discover music and how we're all so similar in the way that those first records, the way they get our blood, our heartbeat racing and our blood coursing. Like Ian McKay, my mom loved the interview with Ian McKay. I promise you she is not a fan of Minor Threat or Fugazi, but the fact that this, you know, kid would be who became this punk icon, which she knows nothing about, but that he's this homeless vet, came to live with his family, and he brought all his records. And I love the idea, first of all, that there's a homeless guy wandering around like, I got no belongings, but I got this crate full of records. I'm mm-hmm. going to take it everywhere I go. That's a man whose priorities are straight. But he would sleep under their piano, and Ian would go through his records, and that's how he discovered the Woodstock soundtrack, and he'd listen to it and under the piano like the homeless vet did, and he'd start imagining like putting on his own music festival. Mm-hmm. And there's just, I mean, that idea, that fantasy when you listen to music, whether it's putting yourself into the performance or within, like taking long road trips and looking out in the field going, that's where I'm going to put my music festival. There's something so relatable about that, where this record comes out of nowhere and it just sparks your imagination in amazing ways. The fact that my mom was like, that guy sounds really cool. It's like, yeah, you shouldn't explore yeah. too much of his canon.
So the experiences you're talking about here, and these artists have, I mean, we all have them. They're bittersweet memories, very formative
yeah.
moments in our lives. Do you think our kids are going to have that? Music seems to have lost a lot of its social currency now. I know my kids aren't as strongly into music as I was when I was young. And God, they've got a house full of records they could choose from, and they're kind of not going that way. I don't know how Charlie is, but if we transport ourselves 20 years in the future, do you think they'll be having similar conversations about music?
I hope so. I mean, I do worry about that because it seems less social, and it seems like with so many ways to explore things online, I mean, YouTube, you can find anything, that they don't seem as curious. But every time I think that, I catch myself and wonder, like, am I just being like my parents or parents of friends, or like the kids today are just, they're so misguided. They're not like, I don't want to be judgmental. I mm-hmm. hope that they are, maybe in ways that we're not aware of, but I don't see it as much. It doesn't seem to be the lifeblood that it once was. Maybe because there are too many other ways to distract yourself. I mean, growing up, when I was a kid in like the 70s and 80s, like MTV came around, but there was like a couple TV shows. I mean, if you wanted to build an identity, if you wanted something that was truly your own, you had to go out and find it and figure it out. And the fact that, you know, YouTube and TikTok, see, I feel like an old man going, the TikTok. I don't get the TikTok. But I'd like to see the more music consumption in ways that, like, that frightens me because I don't understand it. But I love that you're immersing yourself in this strange new music that wasn't made for me. And I don't see that a lot.
That's interesting, because going back to what we were just talking about, the hunt is really kind of the savory bit of the bite.
It is.
But they don't have that now. Right now, there is no hunt. If you want to hear, you know, Wilco, you go straight to, you can do that within 10 seconds, easy. So it's not really satiating anything that we need instinctively from that process.
That is true. Yes, that I can say without fear of feeling like an oldie scolding the young kids. Mm-hmm. It isn't satiating that hunt and gathering thing. I guess you can hunt and gather on YouTube, but I don't see it as much. I'd like, maybe my son is still young, he's 9, but I'd love to come in someday and see him checking out some weird, you know, music on YouTube that he's like, you're not supposed to see this. Like, yes, that's perfect. I want you to find that and have that thing like, you wouldn't understand. Like, I wouldn't. So please continue.
You could actually seed that. All right, Charlie, just whatever you do, don't listen to the residents.
Yes. I beg of you, don't. Please. Yes, exactly. Excellent.
Falling into my trap. But right now, like, for instance, when we were young, again, or back in our day, you know, we would travel across town on a bus with $15 in our pocket, or $10 that took us a week and a half to earn, and we were going to spend it on this one monolithic purchase and take it home, and that was going to be it for the next couple of weeks, and that's our spare time. So there was a much, much greater investment in that whole process than, oh, let's dial something up on YouTube. So that is the experience that I think that the kids may be missing, and again, I don't know what they're going to fill it with.
But maybe there is a thing happening with searching things. I mean, I look all the time on YouTube for old concerts and any, you know, earlier this morning when I should have been writing, I was watching a Black Flag show from 1982 that was spectacular because the cops burst in. Anyway, I mean, that was, for right now, not going out as much, that's satiating my hunting and gathering. It's like, oh, I wonder if I can find, when did, I get these like little things in my head, like, when did Henry Rollins join Black Flag again, like 81. So I want to see some of those early shows, but it has nothing to do with what I'm working on. Somehow it just pops into my head as if it's really, this is important for me to search this out and find this information. So there is some of that if they turn it into the hunting and gathering type thing. But I don't know if you can start from scratch that way. I mean, I have such a, like, I can get down rabbit holes. Once you look up Black Flag in 1982, you could all, it all of a sudden leads you down to these other avenues. And I try to not just go in pure nostalgia, but also like, oh, what is that? Oh, if you like Black Flag in 1982, you might also like, and somehow then all of a sudden you're in the, you know, Japanoids or whatever. So I think with kids, it's, he's going to ignore everything I encourage him to do. So like, let's go to where record store is like, well, that's where it smells like old men. So that's not where he wants to go. But if it's something that he discovers on his own, where, you know, my dad was very much into country music and Willie Nelson, so I wanted nothing to do with that. And he didn't go to a lot of record stores. So it's like, oh, I'm then that record stores are my, that's my, my haven. Mm-hmm. So if we go back to something approaching normalcy and there's a place for them to go and build these musical identities and make these discoveries, other than YouTube, it's mm-hmm. hard not to feel like YouTube is ruining the social aspect of it and the mystery of it and the act of going to a place mm-hmm. and discovering it there and sometimes, you know, without hearing a note.
Yeah, look, I
don't know, or is that romanticizing our past? I don't know.
Well, look, in doing interviews, I think in a similar vein to what you did for the book, speaking to artists, the roots of their musical interests tend to go in one of two different categories. It's not exclusive, but it tends to kind of separate in terms of, number one, their parents were really musical and they have got these amazing memories of being home, being young, and watching their parents react to music, which is, you know, sets them on the path of, wow, this is important. This is what I want to do. And then there's the other half, which tend to be like, I need to get the hell out of this town. And this is my one moonshot out of here. So it tends to be somewhat divided. And I've got no mistake where my, you know, vinyl record penchant came from, right? Is going shopping with my dad. Every Saturday, my dad used to buy me a record, a 45, while he went and shopped for car parts at this, you know, pharmacy, right? And so I remember that was my time with my dad. We spent in this pseudo record store, and that was a memory that's really kind of baked within me. So I suspect you and myself taking our kids to record shops, right now they may seem bored. They may kind of, you know, kick around and not really see a lot that they're interested in. But years from now, I would imagine that there would be these bittersweet memories that they would want to, you know, have great memories in a record store. And maybe that will put them on a path to appreciating what we see in it.
I think you're right. I mean, hearkening back to a question you asked before about one of the sweetest stories, Craig Finn of The Hold Steady told me about wanting to, growing up in the suburbs of Minneapolis and wanting to get, he'd heard about The Replacements and wanting to get Let It Be when it came out, but it was only available in this record store downtown. So he mowed lawns for weeks to raise enough money to get it. And then he had to get a ride down there. So he's asked his dad, like, will you take me down to the cool indie record store? And so his dad's like, oh, all right. So the day they're supposed to go, his dad comes home and he'd been golfing and he has this terrible golf outfit on. And Craig's like, could you please change those clothes? No, come on. It's fine. Let's go. So he's in, and Craig's like a teenager, like 16, and going into this record store, and he's like, I'm mortified. And my dad just is like sticking out like a sore thumb, just this like older white guy dressed in golf clothes. Like, where do you have the rock and roll section? Like, oh God, this is horrifying. And he finds the Let It Be and brings it up. And his dad's like, oh, give it to me. Dad, please don't. No, I'll get it for you. And he's looking at the back like, oh, Gary's got a boner. What's this business all about? Just doing everything to humiliate Craig that he possibly could. But he comes up and he's like, my son would like to buy this. And the record store clerk looks at it and looks up at them and goes, points at them both and says, cool kid, cool dad. And Craig was like, that was the greatest moment of my life. He's like, that's, I didn't have a lot of great memories of my dad, but he's like, that moment, like, weirdly just stayed with me forever. Like, I didn't even appreciate my father that much until that moment, sharing that moment of buying a record. And it just, it still makes him tear up a little bit. And I think that harkens back to what you were saying. I think, I'm so afraid to push too much because I know instinctively when my parents pushed too much towards music or didn't like something, I was like, you don't get me. Mm-hmm. You don't understand where I'm at. But there's something special, a relationship to be forged with music between between parents and their kids.
And it's interesting that the credibility in that story came from the record store clerk. That was where the acceptance came from.
Yes.
These guys are like bishops.
And then he gave them communion and they moved on. Oh, God, that's awesome.
Well, look, Eric, I really enjoy this conversation. I always enjoy speaking with you. And I got to tell you also, going back to episode 32 of this podcast, when I first started this podcast in 2016, and you had the book, Old Records Never Die. I read the book. I loved it. I reached out. We did the interview. It was very early in the career of this podcast, which, you know, we've continued on, and this is episode 2760 something anyway. We've had a lot of fantastic artists on, and a lot of it was built on the foundation of those early episodes. And I do want to thank you for taking the time so many years ago be able to be part of it, because it means a lot. You know, there's these attaboy moments in life to where, you know, sometimes things are kind of difficult to keep surging forward, but then you get the support of folks and you move forward sometimes, you know, reluctantly. Even because you feel you have to, and you were there early on, and again, I do want to share my appreciation for that.
Thank you, Nate. That means an awful lot.
And I got to tell you, I'm really enjoying your books. I read the Jeff Tweedy bio. Your fingerprints are all over that. You give me a similar number of guffaws per minute as Vonnegut. So thank you for
come on. It's like you're giving me a foot massage now. That is awesome.
Gary's got a boner. So I want to recommend people this book, Rockstars on the Record, and it's available at all bookstores. People can pick it up on Kindle. It's a great book to pick up. You read a little bit, you set it down, you walk away with a grin. It's all about records and the influence on records. Anyone who listens to this podcast will definitely get into it, because again, it's these origin stories of a lot of the musical heroes that we have. Also pick up the book, Old Records Never Die. It's absolutely hilarious. And as always, thank you very much, Eric. Much appreciated, mate.
Thank you, Nate. I enjoyed every second of it.
All right, there we go. Mr. Eric Spitznagel. Eric, thank you so much for stopping by the Vinyl Guide and talking all about the book, Rockstars on the Record, as well as Old Records Never Die. Two fantastic books for record collectors, available wherever you get your books. And by the way, if you guys enjoy this conversation, you know, you could have gotten it way earlier if you were part of our Patreon community. Join our Patreon community, patreon.com/vinylguide. You get early access to episodes, extended interviews, secret episodes, and more. And you help support this podcast. You fill my fridge with burritos, and that is hugely welcome. Head over to patreon.com/vinylguide, and we do appreciate your support. And that is it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Please share these episodes on social media. Tweet them out on Twitter, share them on Facebook, tag them in Instagram, whatever you got to do. And even feel free to leave us a positive and utterly charming review on Apple iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. That is hugely appreciated. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.